Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, SARS hits 2 trillion rand, but taxpayers still feel the squeeze. The commissioner joins me in a moment. An education tutor boom is raising red flags for parents and regulators. Local holiday travel holds steady, but our wallets are taking strain. And tourism is still fighting for its place at the center of our economy. It's Thursday, the 2nd of April. Now, SARS, you might have read, has crossed the 2 trillion revenue mark for the first time in our democratic history. That is a milestone, I think, that signals a recovery in tax collection and institutional strength after, let's be honest, a turbulent decade. But beneath the headline obviously sits a tougher question. Is this growth being driven by genuinely expanding economic activity or by more effective enforcement on a relatively small and already compliant tax base? Now, as Edward Kiswetter prepares to step down after 7 years at the helm, there is also the question of legacy, what's truly been fixed at SARS and how durable that progress really is. Commissioner Kiswetter, a very warm welcome. And before we get to those numbers, I just want to ask you quickly to reflect on those 7 years. What are you most proud of? And as you pack up your office, what still concerns you?
Thanks, Jeremy. So I think the most important is that we were very clear from the beginning that this would be a daunting task, but also knew that you could not fix this in a transactional way and without understanding the deep systemic state of disrepair of SARS, not just the hardware, also the software, the people, the trust, the trauma that was exacted on the organization. Actually, technology is easy to fix, and if you're a techno geek like me, It's fun. The hard part is regaining the trust, the hearts and the minds of two important constituencies. The one is your people. You expect them to work harder, so why should they be more engaged? Only if they trust you. From the public, you're going to collect more taxes, so why should they trust you? Well, only if they believe that you do so without fear, favor, or prejudice. And I think the fact that our trust, public trust, have increased from 48% to 75% in this period that I have had the privilege to lead SARS speaks for itself. And our employee engagement, when we did it before COVID, was 61%. And we did it more recently, it was at 71% against a global benchmark of 70%, tells you that this is not a quick fix. It's not a cyclical revenue performance. It is deeply structural and therefore sustainable. So I am proud that we're leaving behind an organization that is future-proof, not just restored to its former glory.
Well, let me pick you up on that. Do you believe you have rebuilt SARS enough to withstand future political or institutional shocks?
I don't think anything can ever resist either a corrupt politician or a corrupt public servant or a corrupt businessman for that matter, because, you know, corruption takes 2 or 3 to tango. But what you can do, if you think of the human body, you go into the world, you know there are viruses and germs, and nothing can prevent you from being exposed to it, but you build an immune system, an immunity system. You make sure that you eat the right foods, you exercise. So immunity comes from the DNA of an organization, not its policies and its regulation, because people will find a way around that. And so what we have done is to heal SARS from the inside out. And then, of course, we've been blessed with a suite of the most modern technologies of AI that also reduces the discretion that people has and makes our decision-making far more evidence-based. It introduces AI agents that can do the routine and repetitive work where people are slow, inefficient, and error-bound. We have been investing in our people to ensure that they can do higher value work where they require judgment, empathy, and the value-added skills that a computer can never do. So I'm confident, Jeremy, that the work we have done has improved the institutional integrity. How do I know that? Well, because the scoreboard says so. We measure everything. Net revenue in the 7 years on a compound annual growth basis is up by 7.8%. In an economy that has been sluggish, our voluntary compliance is up to over 70% for the first time, and taxpayer service went from 54% to over 90%. Taxpayers' attitude towards compliance, and these are institutional integrity measures, up from 66% to 76.5%. Public trust, as I said, 48 to 75%. And our own employees now engaged at 71%. If you have time, I can tell you the return on this investment, both for taxpayers as well as government.
Well, Commissioner, before we get there, let me just ask you to extend that metaphor of immunity, if we can, very quickly. Often immunity is also predicated on the patient or the person getting regular vaccinations. What advice would you then give your successor in order to continue that strong mental and physical health check that you have just outlined to me?
So my first advice would not be to my successor, but to the system that appoints my successor. And the advice there is, because once you've appointed a successor, you have passed the die in many ways. So it is important that whoever is appointed into a role such as important as a commissioner or SARS, it must be a person of good character. It must be a person that has the skills that the job requires. Thirdly, it must have a person that has a track record of delivery. Fourthly, a person that has a work ethic second to none. And lastly, a person that is incorruptible. That's the first level of immunity. Appoint a leadership that can resist the influences, the forces from outside. The commissioner of SARS, even though appointed by the president, cannot be beholden to the president. The commissioner of SARS has to be beholden to the law and his or her conscience. And of course, the president that I had had the privilege of working with understood that. And the minister that I worked with, to their credit, understood that. And I was able to function independently and within the delegated authority of the law. That must continue. Secondly, to ensure that you bring in good people with the right DNA, because, I mean, I know we can do DNA editing today, but fundamentally, if you bring in a person who is not properly vetted, you're inviting the germ or the virus into your organization. So that would be the second level of immunity. Bring in good people that are competent, but that have the right. Our vision is to act in a way that is beyond reproach. After that, technical skills and training is the easy part, but character, DNA, is what builds immunity.
Commissioner, I want to finish with this. How concerned are you as you exit about current global risk, particularly the conflict in the Middle East, and what that could mean in the short to medium term for growth and obviously SARS's ability to collect revenue?
Well, first of all, let me just talk about the war in the Middle East. Two things. Firstly, from a trade perspective, we have minimal impact because our trade from Israel and Iran is around about 1% of our total global trade. So they are relatively low on the rank of trade partners. However, about 80% of our fuel comes from the Middle East. And therefore, the Strait of Hormuz, that entire area, will disrupt eventually when we have gone through our reserves. will have a potential disruption on our supply. It will obviously drive prices down. I don't think we are in a crisis mode as we speak, but it also depends on just how long the war will last. That's the first point about the Middle East. More globally, I think, sadly, there's an African proverb that you would be aware of. You know, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that gets hurt.
Yeah.
It gets damaged. And unfortunately, we have these two big elephants in the world who are posturing, who are staring each other down, and also almost forcing the world into a bipolar plane where countries have to pick sides. And that's bad, because it is a divisive form of leadership, which, quite frankly, I despise. There's no unifying force. South Africa has tried with great difficulty to be impartial, to be nonpartisan, but at times you are drawn into a side without you even knowing it. And the current standoff that we have, for example, with America, is a testament to that. America is one of our big trading partners, but a lot of the position that they've taken is not fact-based. And you can't give in a situation where you know you're playing an unequal game. Your partner, I mean, you did not call it any other word, but your partner on the other side of the table is bigger than you, it is more forceful than you, has more resources than you. And so you force smaller companies to say, well, where can I go that will give me, and there's safety in numbers. And so BRICS becomes more important, for example. And it's not the kind of world we need. So I think, unfortunately, a small economy like us, which is trying to be an open economy, which I support, is exposed to these global forces, and we have shown our resilience to date, but the next few months will test that severely.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. The outgoing Commissioner of the South African Revenue Service, Edward Kiswetter, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa, you might be aware, is seeing a rapid rise in something called tutor centers and alternative learning models. As parents, I imagine, look for flexibility and better outcomes outside the traditional schooling system, which in itself is perfectly understandable. But with that growth has come some confusion, some gaps in regulation, and what you're about to hear, in some cases, outright exploitation, with some centres operating like full-time schools without proper registration or oversight. Well, someone who's got his eye on this particular issue from the South African Comprehensive Assessment Institute, Chris Klopper, a very warm welcome to you. Explain to me then what is happening and how big a problem this is.
Well, let's put it like that. Many of the parents, they opt for homeschooling. That's where the whole thing starts. So in terms of Section 51 of the SA Schools Act, a parent has to register that particular learner if that learner is in grade R to grade 9 with the education department, the provincial education department, as a homeschooler. And then that particular parent then either has a few options. That particular parent can then either act as the teacher of that particular learner. Or what they then do sometimes is they use a curriculum provider, and that is one of these distance education providers or an online school. And then in other cases, they go to a learning center. And I think going to the learning center is where many of the problems arise, because in life, in all sectors, you get those tutor centers or those learning centers, as we call them, that are the specialist learning centers, for example, in mathematics, physical science, and in home languages. And they provide a wonderful service. Mm. And then you also get then the others who act as if they are registered private schools. And that is where the problem arises, because from our perspective as an assessment body, our concern is that the quality of learning and teaching at many of those centers are not up to standard. And I think that is what the parents must be aware of, that when they opt for a learning center to place their kids, first of all, if that kid is let's say, part of the compulsory school going age, that is from, let's say, from 5 to 15 years, they must ensure that it is a competent learning center that is able to provide quality assistance, because the parent still remains the primary educator for that particular learner.
Let's talk about that quality of assistance then. What basic minimum standards do these centers need to adhere to?
What we have done from our side as an assessment body is because we are concerned that what we have found is that many of the learners coming from, let's say, the homeschool environment and where those learners were not subjected to proper discipline, proper teaching and learning, is that they are not up to standard. And that is why we are now expecting them to write the benchmark exam to see if they truly belong in the further education and training phase, that is in grade 10, 11 and 12. And what many of the parents must also understand that it's not only affordability, it also deals with let's say, those underlying principles that relate to quality learning and teaching. That is, first of all, the old adage of the ABC, apply bottom to chair. You have to apply your bottom to the chair and you have to sit there for at least 20 hours a week. There's no shortcut in the learning process. And then, of course, the question of subject specialists, because someone can speak a particular language doesn't, for example, mean that he or she is a language teacher. And the same goes for mathematics, same goes for physical science, the same goes for accountancy. You need subject specialists to teach those learners, you know, the proper knowledge that they have to attain at the end of each phase.
And the consequence here is the children, I imagine, risk ending up with an invalid qualification.
Well, the invalid qualification comes when they end grade 9, for example, and then they have to enroll with one of the assessment bodies for grades 10, 11, and 12. And then in many cases, these learners are just not up to standard. And that is why I made mention of a benchmark exam to ascertain if that particular learner is really up to standard. If they enroll for the FET phase, that's grades 9, 10, well, that's grades 10, 11, and 12, they fall under our auspices. We have very, very strict checks and balances to ensure that those learners comply with all the promotion requirements. But up until the end of grade 9, in many cases, it is a free-for-all. I'm not saying I don't want to generalize, but it is important that parents must take note that it's not only the question of costs, but also the quality of learning and teaching that takes place.
Is it easy, Chris, for an operator to appear legitimate but not be?
Yes, it is. Because many of these learning centres, they establish themselves as a centre that is responsible for learning. And what they then do is then they advertise. And you can go, for example, in Nordakersweg, you know, in Roodepoort, and you will find many of these centres there. And some of them are excellent. Let's put it like that. Some of them are excellent, others are not. For example, let me give you an example. We spoke to one of these learning centers that wanted to register with us as a so-called distance education provider. And we asked them, tell us what type of information are you sharing with parents? What type of learning knowledge are you sharing with parents? And they said, no. At the end of grade 12, we will provide them with a certificate of the school, but it doesn't mean that it is a certified certificate. It doesn't mean that they can use it. It's just a certificate. And we think that something like that is unacceptable. It gives the wrong impression to parents. It's misrepresentation in terms of contract law. And what you're doing is an absolute injustice to those kids. So the long and the short of it is there's no shortcut. Make sure that the quality is up to standard. Do not only look at costs, because quality education is a bit more expensive than, let's say, non-quality education. And then make sure that particular center is registered with either a registered online school or a registered distance education provider. Because if a distance education provider, an online school, registers with us, they have to comply with certain minimum requirements and they have to comply with assessment standards. And I think that is important that parents must take note of.
And just
they are welcome to phone us and we can point them in the right direction.
Just a final one then, aside from that registration process that you talk about, are there other red flags then that parents should be looking out for?
Oh, yes. The first one is, for example, if they are under the impression that this particular learning center may be a, let's say, a private school or independent school, the first thing they must ask, tell us, where's your EMIS number? And that is the number that the Provincial Department of Education provides to an independent school, a registered independent school. And then secondly, show us your Umalusi accreditation certificate.
Chris,
and if those two documents are not available, then it's not a registered independent school.
Chris Klopper, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Comprehensive Assessment Institute.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africans, and I guess this is good news, are still planning to travel this Easter, but they are doing it differently. We are cutting costs, we're shortening trips, and increasingly choosing road travel over flights. Why? Well, as rising fuel prices and broader cost pressures bite into our budgets. So the appetite to travel is still there, but the way people are defining value is clearly shifting. So let's get a view on that from Enver Dumini, who's Chief Executive Officer of Cape Town Tourism. Enver, a very warm welcome to you. So the subtext here is that we're not giving up travel, we're simply adjusting our behavior. Do you think this is resilience or early signs of strain as a result of the increasing geopolitical tension around the world?
Well, Jimmy, that's a very good question. I think from what we've seen in the survey is that it's just a shift in travel behavior. We are going into the Easter period. Those that we did interview had, of course, indicated that they had already pre-purchased flights and accommodation, and so therefore they are honoring that. And of course, for them, it's not just a luxury, it's also a well-deserved break, especially with what's going on. Cost of living pressures is a reality, and I think what they are doing is they're adapting their itinerary and their travel program. In fact, some are saying they are going to be spending less on, let's say, eating out or some other general activities, but they still intend to travel. While there are others that are saying, well, look here, I want to stay a little bit longer, so I'm actually going to downscale in other areas. And so we do see that as a change in travel behavior. The intent is still there, which is good. And then when you speak to the operators on the ground, they said, well, look here, the bookings are still remaining positive from a domestic perspective. And so that remains encouraging. So we can see that overlap. Whether it's an indicator of the resilience and the pressure, I think that is something we're still all watching at this stage. We haven't seen an indication that there's anything to panic about, but I think the longer the Middle East conflict continues, rising pressure on fuel costs and, of course, then on operating costs, and we know that food costs and all these other things will have a lag effect, and that will, of course, put pressure on the industry. But in the conversation, again, with some of our members and partners, they are trying their best to absorb that cost. But of course, the longer it continues, that pressure will have to give in at some stage and may even be passed on to the consumer.
Which is going to make things more difficult for operators, and people in your position are going to have to rethink strategy and approach. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, I think for us, it's about understanding again what the change in travel behavior is and, of course, adapting our products. Affordability is a global issue, not just a local one. And I think, again, this is where smarter reviews of operating efficiencies, costs, margins, and they're not kind of just pushing profitability at any cost. I think this is where both the visitor and the industry need to say, well, how do we ensure sustainability? And we're all going to have to give and take a little bit. But I think, again, that strategy is also how we market the destination, how we also ensure that there's so many things to do in a destination, whether that's Cape Town, Joburg, Durban, that people can do on various budgets. And I think, again, this is where operators need to become a lot smarter, understand the shift in travel behavior, and then meet that requirements, whether it's more flexible cancellation policies, additional value adds to an experience. We're even bundling certain things with an airline and with attractions so that they don't have to kind of duplicate spending on marketing. And I think that's where an organization like Cape Town Tourism comes in, is that because we've got certain marketing platforms, we can then, of course, work with industry and say, let's package together smarter instead of kind of doing it in silos. So those conversations are happening. But I think also what we are looking at is, again, how do we also add new products into the market? And that becomes a continuous thing, whether there was pressure on the domestic or international market. Those are things we continue to do irrespective.
Difficult, though, for businesses if margins are being squeezed across the industry to adapt, as you're suggesting, their approach and even product and service to more price-sensitive consumers.
No, absolutely. And I think that's always the question for us is how long and how far. And, you know, we can have all these strategies and tactics in place, but of course, tourism is a demand-led industry. And we are going to have to find ways to sustain that. You know, even in conversations we're having with government, again, looking at some of the benefits, some of the zoning, the cost is how do we all absorb something over the medium to long term so that we can sustain the industry, ensure visitors still have a memorable experience and are willing to part with their precious money. And then, of course, to make sure that ultimately we can all get through it. Because, again, that has been proven time and time again, whether it was the water crisis, COVID, et cetera, is that we remain resilient. But we need to do that in collaboration with communities, with the employees within the sector, and, of course, with the visitors and government.
Difficult, of course, to remain resilient, given that there are so many unknowns, particularly around something like the fuel price. And we really just don't know where that's going to go.
No, absolutely. And I think when there's uncertainty, that's where it's critical for different partners to get together and have conversations and also share what the plans are. Because I think also when we operate in silos, we have these echo conversations within, let's say, accommodation, within tourism, even with let's say, banking. But the critical thing is for us to get together and start sharing these ideas. And in fact, that's what we've been doing as Cape Town Tourism, is engaging with different partners, different sectors, because we understand that tourism covers quite a few of those sectors. And we're all feeling the same pressures, but we don't have to do it alone. And I think that's the critical thing. But you're right, you know, the longer this happens. But we've also seen this before, that travel demand shifts. What's happening in the Middle East, of course, people are going to choose alternative destinations to go to. Airlines still have to fly. So I think everybody's going to feel the pain. The question is, again, to your point, is for how long? And in uncertainty, we need to have at least some forms of plans of action, and that's what we are busy with. And hopefully the conflict can resolve itself quickly and some level of normalcy can start returning. But again, you know, we don't know. We don't have a crystal ball. And all we can do is continue to evaluate and adjust all our plans and programs.
Enver Dumini is the Chief Executive Officer of Cape Town Tourism.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Let's move on to this now. And tourism contributes significantly to South Africa's economy and job creation. I think that's a given. Yet it continues often to be treated as a secondary sector rather than a core pillar of economic growth. Why? At a time when the country is searching for scalable, labor-intensive opportunities, I think the question is whether tourism is possibly being underestimated or maybe even under-supported at policy level. Let's dive into that conversation with Jerry Mabena, who's chairperson of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. Jerry, welcome, and maybe some context, and let me start with a big picture if I can. Why do you think tourism is not treated more as a big, important strategic infrastructure?
Let me start by saying tourism is not one thing. I think sometimes that's really where the problem starts. We've got your accommodation, you've got vehicle operators, you've got all these other elements that touch on tourism. And sometimes we forget that it even touches on agriculture and manufacturing. So when you aggregate all those things, I think the value then gets lost somewhere in the calculations by the economists in terms of the true value of what tourism means for the country.
So what do you think specifically they're missing out on then?
It's a number of things. I think one is, as a tool, tourism doesn't exist in one singular place. For an instance, you can go and live and have an experience in Johannesburg. You can go have an experience in the middle of the Kruger. You can go and have an experience in the middle of the, call it Northern Cape. And those would be very different. And they would touch on different things. When you do the wine route in the winelands, most people actually forget that that's tourism influencing agriculture, just by way of an example. When you have a big development, like you're seeing a lot of stuff happening on the V&A waterfront, a lot of it, some of the stuff is driven by tourists coming into the country, needing places to stay, needing something to do. And that then has a ripple effect into the manufacturing sector, whether it's furniture, it's the guys who make the tiles, it's labor itself. I mean, tourism, I mean, one in 18 jobs in South Africa currently is linked onto tourism. So that's where we really miss that calculation.
So how then do you elevate tourism as a concept to the apex of the triangle? Because, Jerry, I would suggest to you that it's very difficult to pull together a cohesive thread in that respect. It's more than just one big policy constraint, isn't it?
Indeed it is. And I think it's one big policy constraint, and it's multifaceted because it touches on so many different areas. I mean, we once had a conversation about Robben Island just as a destination. And when we were having that discussion, we realized the number of entities that Robben Island touches, and you can't make one singular decision. But I think the important thing is, if we then recognize that tourism as a sector creates these number of jobs, and then we say we want the jobs, let's focus on that. Let's focus on creating the jobs and then say, how is tourism as a medium able to do that. And then the other sectors will benefit out of that. I think if we start talking like that, you'll probably find that there's better alignment in what we say. I mean, jobs are a big thing in the country. I mean, the level of unemployment is completely unsustainable. Mm.
I really don't like that word alignment, but I understand what you're saying. And I would ask you, is it more of a government problem then or a private sector issue if you're trying to achieve that alignment?
I'm not sure. And I think the conversations we're having at the Tourism Business Council is saying, what are the things that we as business can do? And I think let's start there. And for me, it's easier to get government to partner with us if we know where we want to go, because they have their own strategy, which is driven by other policy and political imperatives. But there could be an alignment in where some of those things happen. Let me make an example. For instance, when you talk about, you know, the number of people who talk about development of SMMEs and small businesses, and tourism is a great medium to drive those kind of, it's a very low barrier to entry sector. So you allow people to come in at a very low level. And in doing that, I think government and private sector can participate in a collaborative manner. And we're beginning to do that, by the way, at least with our partners in the tourism sector.
Having said that, though, I would also suggest to you that you're probably still quite far apart, given that the private sector and the public sector do understandably have a competing set of priorities.
Well, yes and no. And I say yes and no because all of us want to create jobs when all is said and done. How everybody does it might differ. So let's kind of say to ourselves, where are the common areas of interface? And if jobs is one of them, what are the things that we can do jointly that can drive jobs? And there could be certain areas where they think that, where government believes that they need to make a focus on. And by and large, I think, you know, the separation of objectives, I think it's a mental thing as opposed to a real substantive thing, if you come to think of it.
What about building the basics, though? For instance, are we competitively priced globally? Are we still being held back by onerous visa rules?
Now, that's where then the partnership with government starts happening in a very good way. I mean, and we've started working on that. I'm glad you asked that, Jeremy. The visa issues, for instance, have been a big limiting factor. And there has been work that has been happening between ourselves as TBCSA together with government through the Operation Vulindlela initiative. We started the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme a couple of years ago. And in the last year, I think the minister in the Department of Foreign Affairs started announcing, Home Affairs, announcing the Electronic Travel Assistance Program, which allows for people to then start applying for their visas online. And they can get their visas in literally, I think it's 48 to 72 hours, if my memory serves me well. Mm. So when you start having those things, then you're opening the market. And then the next one, for instance, which is where the partnership also happens, is the issue of air access. I mean, as private sector, we don't control EXA. We don't control what happens in terms of airlines coming into the country. But in a collaborative effort, we are beginning to now work of driving landing opportunities, flights going into areas like KZN, like Gauteng, Western Cape. We have been very, very involved in partnering with those provincial governments. Now we want to move that onto a national level and actually say, at a national level, what can we do to make sure that now more airlines land in South Africa to bring people into the country?
Well, good to see that some progress is being made. Jerry Mabena, thank you very much indeed, Chairperson of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. And that is our program for today and, in fact, for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.